to the Wintrust Business Lunch. It's Suzanne Muchen standing in for Steve Bertrand, who is still out recovering but doing really well. And just a note that I did write all my own words today. There's no plagiarism. I'm going on record and saying that. So we have a lot of great guests coming up today. We're going to hear about the Chicago Cabby Award later in the show. But right now we have John Najarian from the Najarian Family Offices. Hey, John.
Hello, Suzanne. Great to be with you. I'm over here in London today.
Are you? You really have a great radio voice. Wow.
Oh, well, thank you for that. So do you.
Well, thank you. Good thing I do. So I'm wondering, you're over in London, but I'm assuming you're tracking the RNC convention carefully, right?
Indeed. I don't know if there's too many ways any of us could invest or make money based on what's happened so far. Because plagiarism or any of that sort of thing are really not investable items yet.
Exactly.
But there may be some other things that do come up at the convention. So, I know all the gun manufacturers and so forth are going to be watching it closely.
And so I'm wondering, does the RNC convention affect the stock market in visible ways? I mean, how sensitive is the stock market to what's going on at the convention?
Suzanne, I'd say very limited stock market catalysts in the Republican convention. Could be far more in the Democrat, and I'm not choosing sides by saying that. I'm just saying Hillary Clinton has been an outspoken opponent of many of the big biotech and health insurance companies. So those tend to move lower whenever she seems to be rising in the polls. So not so much on the Republican side could you pin one certain group or groups, even defense stocks, to what Mr. Trump or his vice president, Mr. Pence, might say, but far more likely that we could be influenced by what Hillary says at the Democratic convention.
Very interesting. And so you mentioned before about investable propositions. How are you reading the whole businessman, Mr. Trump as a businessman? Do you think that that's playing very well into people looking for potential investments?
I don't really think so at this time, Suzanne. I think overall there's just a widespread dislike of both of these two candidates.
Right.
Plenty of hate on both sides, apparently, but not a lot of, like I say, investable theses, certainly not from our side. We're not for clients positioning ourselves, except that we're a little lighter in the biotech space than I would be if, for instance, if Hillary were to be slipping in the polls either before or after her convention, then I'd say that is a space that we could load up on because it has gotten very cheap ahead of the Democratic convention.
That is very exciting. And so in the biotech world, first of all, can you just explain to the listeners what biotech is?
Sure. So, for instance, companies like Biogen or Amgen or Celgene, companies that basically take either known DNA and so forth and might modify it or find a way to have one cell turn against another cell, all those kinds of companies would be referred to as biotechnology. So not just straight medicines that go in and perhaps stop you from sneezing or hopefully stop other maladies, but the sorts of things that might cause a cancer cell to reverse and start cutting off the blood supply to that cancer cell through the use of biotechnology. That might be one of the real breakthrough products that a company would be producing right now and could cause dramatic upside, but that research is quite expensive, and they pass it along in the form of very expensive drugs.
And this is a field that's exploding in terms of new businesses, new products, right?
Absolutely. Whether it's AIDS or whether it's multiple sclerosis, ALS, or something like cancers of all sorts, cervical, prostate, breast cancers, all of those sorts of things. Any of those are probably $10 or $20 billion businesses going forward. And regardless of who the president is, many of the companies that are finding those cures will be worth a lot more in the years to come than they are right now.
Absolutely.
But volatility about Hillary is why they're sort of knocked down a little bit. And again, that's not meant as a slam against her.
It's oh, just, you're being super diplomatic. Very. Maybe it's okay. Because you're in London and they kind of lay low over there. No, you sound very apolitical. Good job.
Okay.
And good. So my last question is, have you been over to the Matter space over here in Chicago?
I have not. You know, I probably haven't been spending nearly enough time. When I'm there, I'm with my family more than traveling about, but I should get over and see that, I guess.
So you should go over there. It's a health tech incubator, right? Companies are renting desks there when they're very early and nascent stages. Lots of biotech companies over there. And it's really been, I don't know if you've heard of 1871 in Chicago, but it's really become an innovation center for a lot of the really interesting Chicago-based companies. And it's just a thriving area, even here in Chicago. And a lot of people are attributing that to the presence of universities and the big healthcare companies. So it's over in the Merchandise Mart. I really think you'd have a lot of fun going over there.
Absolutely. And I've heard of the 1871 area with technology and the Google Center or campus that's over in that same direction. But I applaud, that's one of the reasons I applaud Mayor Emanuel for getting many of these projects off the ground, because I think those could be really massive employment opportunities for Chicago going forward. And it's certainly attracting a lot of those, like you say, young professionals to the area.
Right. People are saying that part of it is these hubs that are coming into play. And it's also the fact that housing is actually relatively affordable here in Chicago, unlike on the coasts. So we have these young people who would probably leave because they simply couldn't afford to be in the startup space. And in fact, they're staying. And I would think that biotech in particular requires a lot of capital.
Yep, a lot of capital to get through not only the development of the drug, but then stage one, stage two, stage three.
Yes.
Some of those testing phases can cost in the tens of millions in each phase, so that you might be 100 million deep into that drug before it's approved for use on human beings. Again, one of the reasons it's so expensive to produce those drugs.
But then potentially a very big upside.
Huge upside. And so that's why I say I'm confident many of those companies will be worth a lot more, no matter who is president 5 years from now. But in the short term, I think volatility will center around one candidate in particular.
John Najarian from the Najarian Family Offices, thanks for calling in from London. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Suzanne. Have a great afternoon.
You too. Welcome back. It's Suzanne Mushin. I'm standing in for Steve Bertrand on the Wintrust Business Lunch. So Andrew Herman and I, Andrew's from DNA Info, usually pass each other in the very fancy green room.
Yeah.
And today the tables have kind of turned. I feel like you might be intimidated by me today.
I am all set for whatever you might need of me.
Okay, because you look like really calm, cool, and collected. So I really want to talk about Father and Son Pizza, uh-huh, because you're talking about the fact that they're looking to expand in Logan Square, but they really have an interesting backstory. I mean, I would hope they would with Father and Son. It sort of suggests that there's a history there.
Right, so they are at 2475 North Milwaukee Avenue, and they've been there since 1965. They started years ago before that, actually, on the south side, and took the family recipe north. And they really got their footing into the pizza business in Chicago back in the mid-60s. They claimed that they were the first to deliver pizzas on the north side.
Wow.
And they used off-duty cops and firefighters, and it took off, and they've been hanging in there in Logan Square for a long time. And, you know, like a lot of Chicago neighborhoods, you have your ups and downs, and economically, and just a transient nature of the city, I suppose. And Logan Square is back on the upswing. And the family there, as you say, is looking to build a four-story addition to kind of grab on to this big wave of success that's rolling through Logan.
It's interesting. We've been having a lot of guests in the studio, at least when I've been here. Maybe it's something about me that makes people bring food in. But there's been a lot of food. But each time the discussion has turned to the healthier side of Chicago's palate, that things are really shifting. I wonder if Father and Son is going to see any pushback, given the fact that today, you know, pizza's consider to be unhealthy?
You know, people are leaving the meat off of pizza and thinking it's health food.
Right.
I know that's how we do it in
our family.
Or
throwing on some green peppers.
That's right. It's actually just a big vegetable dish with some tomato paste. But, you know, everybody loves pizza, and they're just seeing all kinds of traffic in Logan Square now. It was recently named one of the hottest urban retail markets in the country by Cushman & Wakefield.
I saw that. So what's interesting is, first of all, the idea that Logan Square is sort of like hipster central, mm-hmm. at least I grew up here, that was not the case.
Yeah.
But they're also saying that Wicker Park and Bucktown are now, which used to be the sort of edgier communities, are now becoming more status quo.
Yeah.
So what do you think it is about Logan Square that's making it this cool place again?
Well, I think it's probably cheaper to live there. So you have a younger audience looking probably to rent, and the rents are easier to cover. You know, if you're into living in hot neighborhoods, the hotness is transient in and of itself, right? I mean, when you look at the history of Logan Square, this is where Mike Royko grew up,
right.
Above a tavern, you know, and he would tell all these great stories about all these ethnic characters, you know, out of there. And it has completely changed now. And you're getting a more affluent group. The ranking said that the average household income in Logan Square is now about $85,000,
right.
Which is pretty decent.
Right.
60% are college educated. Nationally, that's about 40%. So you've got a younger group. 1 in 3 are between the ages of 20 and 34. All these things come together.
Right.
And if you're in retail, man, that's who you want.
I was just going to say, that's who you want living there, right? It really will attract probably a different kind of retail store, restaurants, et cetera.
Right. I mean, you have young people, and they spend their money in certain ways, right? They love entertainment.
Yeah.
So that's good for a pizza business, right? They like to go out to eat. And if you're in any kind of retail that's selling them the things that they need to launch their lives, you know, mattresses and furniture and all that stuff, this would be a great place to go into Logan Square. But they are seeing, you know, increased rents themselves as they heat up, you know, just the market forces at work there. And you are also seeing some pushback by long-term residents. A lot of people in Logan Square move there from Wicker Park, and they're like more like arts type people.
Right.
You know, they get pushed out of Wicker, then they get into Logan, and all of a sudden they're seeing their own rents go up, and it just, they will, I guess they're moving to Humboldt now.
Exactly. That's what we'll be talking about next. What's interesting to me is that I think Chicago is still really a city of neighborhoods.
Mm.
You know, I'm a marathon runner, so part of the joy, the small piece of joy when you're in pain of going through is really being in a neighborhood, going through Pilsen, going through Chinatown, really seeing it. And I think that Logan Square is one of those places that really feels like a neighborhood.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the DNA Info, if I could give a plug, that's what we're built on. We cover the neighbors. We have reporters. Paul Biesco is in Logan Square, and we have reporters across the city. And they are such distinct places, and they have people who really care about their neighbors, their neighborhoods and their neighbors. And there's a lot of interesting stories that come out of there. But it's reflective of this sort of put a stake in the ground and say, I live in the city of Chicago. I'm a Chicagoan, but I really live in Logan Square or Lincoln.
With some
Lincoln
pride,
Square.
Right?
Yeah, right, right. And so that's why you sometimes get pushback when things start changing and people feel like they're being pushed out of their neighborhood.
And I do hope in that scenario of Logan Square becoming more hip that father and son still thrives, because part of what you're also seeing in neighborhoods, especially in sort of Southport and those corridors, you know, the big box stores, big brands coming in and taking away a lot of the mom and pop. And still, father and son feels to me local, family owned, been around a long time. So, you know, we hope they succeed.
Well, you know, we do cover a lot of openings and closings and business on and DNA Info. And you do see the big box coming and going. We see, like, even in Lincoln Square or Lincoln Park this week, a Target is opening in Lincoln Park.
Right.
But on the periphery of that, you do have small businesses coming and going. So I don't think the independent businessman is dead in the city. In fact, they seem to thrive more here than in the suburbs. That's my estimation.
And are you seeing that the neighborhood works best where there's a mixture of the big box and independent?
Yeah, I mean, people complain about big boxes and then they go to them.
Right.
I mean, I think having a Target in your neighborhood is probably a pretty nice thing, but you do also want an independently owned restaurant and a bar and maybe, some sort of service businesses to get your hair cut.
Right.
And, you know, that makes the flavor and the character of the neighborhood. But you still like to be connected to the Targets of the world,
sure,
because they have cool stuff at reasonable prices. And so you constantly have this sort of mix going on in the city, and if you don't have enough of one or you have too much of the other, you really do have some problems living
right
in the neighborhoods.
Andrew Herman, DNA Info, thank you so much.
Okay.
And I'll pass you in the green room next week.
Absolutely.
It's time for a quick break, and we'll be back to the Wintrust Business Lunch. Welcome back to the Wintrust Business Lunch. I'm Suzanne Muschen, standing in for Steve Bertrand, who is out but on the mend. And I'm really excited to have our next guest in the studio, because I know we've all experienced the problem that his company is solving, which has to do with the referral management system in the medical field. So Scott Vold, who's a founder of Fibroblast, that's kind of a mouthful. Fibroblast.
It is. Do you know? First of all, thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here.
My pleasure. Do you know what a fibroblast is?
No.
Okay. Most people don't, right?
Okay. That was sort of a trick question.
Yeah, sure. It is. So a fibroblast is the cell in your body that forms connective tissues, right?
Got it.
It's something that medical students and doctors learn about on a daily basis, but it really describes what we do, which is connecting patients with their doctors and connecting doctors with each other.
And you do that at a moment that is right now pretty much a big miss, right? When I get referred to another doctor. So let's say I go in for a checkup and my doctor says, oh, you should really get your eyes checked out, or you should really go to a specialist. I hear that information, but unless somebody really hounds me about it, I'm not likely to follow up. So how is that the problem you're solving?
That's exactly it. And maybe I should step back a little bit and tell you about the origin of our company, because I think that informs the problem. So I'm a recovering lawyer.
I know that, right?
Yeah,
that's why I said. So Scott walked into the studio with his T-shirt on that says Fibroblast, and I'm thinking, wow, I bet you couldn't dress like that back in the day.
That's right. And my former office is actually down the street here. So I'm a recovering lawyer, and I was, at the time, my co-founder and I came up with the company, I was practicing law and very dissatisfied, and I had the idea for a totally different business in healthcare. And he's a practicing physician, and I took him out to breakfast to talk to him about this idea that I had, and I was pitching him on it, and as a first-time entrepreneur, had really no idea where I was going. And he was very distracted. And so finally, after 10 or 15 minutes of talking, I said, okay, you know, what's going on? And he told me this really horrific story that resonated deeply with me and is unfortunately far too common. And I think maybe it'll resonate with a lot of the listeners. So a patient went to see a colleague of his. His colleague was a primary care doctor, family practitioner. Patient went in and for a physical. And the doctor examined the patient and said, you know, everything checks out. Everything's okay except one thing. You have a little bit of blood in your urine, a microscopic hematuria. It means bleeding in your bladder. To you, you don't see it with your naked eye. You don't feel any pain. But as a doctor, it's concerning enough to me that I think you should really follow up with somebody. And so the doctor reverted to the state of the art in managing patient referrals, which is to take out a piece of paper.
I was going to say, right, what did that look like?
Exactly.
A pad. Right?
Yeah, piece of paper and a pen, and wrote the name and number of this urologist on it and handed it to the patient and said, really, you should really get this checked out. And like everyone else, the patient said, sure, and agreed to it. And then went on about his day and probably put the piece of paper in his pocket or his briefcase and promptly forgot about it. And 18 months later, unfortunately, the patient wound up dying of bladder cancer.
Oh, my God.
Right. So by the time the patient got around to seeing a specialist and maybe seeing some symptoms, it was unfortunately too late.
So can I ask you a legal question? So does that end up causing a problem for the doctor who made the referral, or is he not accountable or she not accountable once they write the piece of paper?
Yeah, so a couple things. I didn't practice medical malpractice law, and you shouldn't rely on any of my judgment, in my
what
opinion.
What Scott is about to say, do not listen.
That's exactly right. But it's funny you bring that up, because that's exactly the question my co-founder, Andrew, asked me. He said, look, I'm a gastroenterologist, and I see patients all the time for, you know, a variety of GI issues. And I give someone a colonoscopy, and I see that they have cancer. And the first words out of their mouth are, You know, I wish I would have followed up when I was 50.
Right.
And so how can I avoid what happened here? But also, how can I make sure that I don't get sued and my colleagues don't get sued?
Because it's a big issue.
It is. And in the story that I was telling you, the part that I actually left out where you went was both doctors were sued.
Oh, well, there you go.
And so, you know, there's this concept of a failure to diagnose or delayed diagnosis, and there's all kinds of legal issues there. And that was really the genesis of the company. It was, how do you ensure that a patient doesn't slip through a crack and make sure the patient gets the care they need? But B, at first it was, how do you also ensure that doctors are doing whatever they can do to ensure that they document what's happening with the referral and aren't sued later on?
So is your company facing the doctor as the customer?
So we face kind of three stakeholders. Mm-hmm. We have patients as number one. Number two are those that provide medical care or work in the clinics. So doctors, schedulers, staff members. And then third, generally they are business leaders or strategic leaders of a health system. So okay. It could be the CEO, it could be the chief medical officer, it could be the chief financial officer. And we have all kinds of tools to give those stakeholders analysis and reporting about how their business is performing.
I mean, I'm just sitting here listening to this thinking, who wouldn't want to have this tool? I mean, not saying that just to plug you. I know that was probably a good plug. No, really, though. What would be the argument against using Fibroblast?
Yeah, that's a great question. So there are a few, I think a few things here. Number one is that, you know, the healthcare industry is difficult to sell into. These are large organizations who don't have good buying processes. They're very conservative in how they buy technology. And there's a cultural shift happening where you have the old way of doing things on paper to the new way of doing things, which is a solution like ours that's automated and provides accountability and transparency into clinical practice.
So Scott Vold, who is one of the founders?
I'm the co-founder.
Co-founder of Fibroblast, and your guys are over at Matter.
Correct. We went through Accelerate Labs or TechStars.
Right.
Back in the day, and then we're at Matter now.
Well, I'll just close out by saying I think this better suits you than the suit and tie, Scott.
I think it does, too. Thank you very much for having me today.
I'm so glad you were here. Thank you. And let's take a quick break, and we'll be back to the show. The Wintrust Business Lunch. This is Suzanne Mushin, and I'm standing in for, actually I'm sitting in, I'm really not standing, for Steve Bertrand, who is out but on the mend. And I know that I gave Steve some homework. So if you're listening to this, Steve, I know you're listening to my podcast, The Big Payoff. That was one of your assignments. We're going to discuss it when you return, so get ready. And now we have Micah Stambaugh, who is a spokesperson for business affairs and consent protection, talking about what I think is an incredibly exciting award that is about to be given through a competition for Chicago's top cabbie. Micah, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me. I'm excited.
Oh, I'm excited too. I feel like our cab drivers often don't get the recognition they need, and it feels sort of thankless.
It's true. You're 100% correct. And that was kind of one of the reasons why we thought of this contest. It was really designed to reward a licensed chauffeur for being, you know, the best driver, doing something that people would never expect, exemplary service, some kind of heroism. I mean, we see it here at the department, but when you're out in the public, you kind of always hear the bad stories.
Absolutely.
So we wanted to just kind of spark industry-wide pride from all of our drivers and reward one of them with a free taxicab medallion.
And so what does that mean for the driver if they're awarded this medallion?
So basically, it's their financial freedom. They become a small business owner in their own industry. Typically, a driver that does not own a medallion has to lease a cab and pay whatever the lease rate is. This way, they can go and drive under their own medallion and pocket that money that they were otherwise spending for their daily lease.
That's really a big deal to them.
Yeah, it is. You know, and some people are like, oh, you know, well, you know, why does that affect me? I'm like, well, there are 12,000 taxi cab drivers that it does affect.
Absolutely. I mean, how many of us rely from minute to minute, hour to hour? And I think what's interesting is if you're conscious now, what I love about you coming on the show is now when I get into a cab, because oftentimes you don't look at the name or look at the license, but we're actually asking you to do this because the competition is open through July 20th. So what do I have to do if I get into a cab, which I'm going to do right after the show? What do I have to do to vote if my cab driver is phenomenal?
Okay, well, that's great. I'm glad that you are having us on so we can share this. So this, just so I can let everyone know, it started May 20th, and it ran for 2 months, the nomination period. So tomorrow is the last day, so we're kind of just getting everyone's excitement for the last 24 hours so that if they do get into a good cab, take the cab number down, kind of note the time it was around, call 311, nominate the cab driver. If a passenger used Curb, there, once they go through the whole process where they pay via the app, there is a comment section and they can nominate the cab driver in the comment section, or they can go to www.shytopcabbie.com and we will direct you to the nomination process there. But it really is, it's imperative that people do this.
And do you see any change in the behavior of the drivers since you've announced this competition?
You know, honestly, I haven't looked at that data, but I do know that I can say I probably get a handful of texts every couple days from friends that are like, I just nominated the best cab driver ever, and typically I wasn't getting any response like that from friends or coworkers.
Look, so, a good cab driver can make your day, and a bad one can ruin it.
Yeah. And, you know, we do think that they are the ambassadors of our city. They're
absolutely
sometimes the first person that people are greeted by when they fly into our city or come into the city via another means of transportation. And they have to be reliable and know where they're going and friendly. And we really want to reward the Chicago Staff Cabbie.
Right. There's this beautiful commercial right now. I'm not quite sure who it's for, but I'm going to try to figure it out so we can post it, which is seen through the eyes of this woman cab driver. She's older, and it keeps tracking as different people get in her car who are, you know, celebrating. They're about to go to a wedding, or a soldier gets in who's clearly nervous and about to get dropped off at the airport. I mean, you just think about the stories and the human connection that's every day in that back seat, and really, we need to give some attention to those drivers.
Yeah. I mean, I have been peeking at the nominations as I see them coming through, and some of the stories are just, they're really remarkable. So I'm excited to share. And kind of what happens next, after the nomination period closes tomorrow, we have a special task force that will go through all of the, we have about 500 nominations right now that will go through. They will all be vetted, and we will pick the top finalists, and the finalists will be posted on BACP's website along with their kind of background story as well as some of the nominations that came in so that people can vote, and then it will be open to the public and the public can choose the winner.
So when will the actual choice be made?
I don't have a hard date yet. I'll be able to let you know, but it's going to depend on kind of the vetting process and background search to make sure that everyone that we are nominating is cleared to make it to the next level.
Okay, Micah. Well, I'm going to personally invite you. I know Steve would feel the same. To come here with that top cabbie.
Awesome.
Let's talk to him or her and get their story and give them a little love. So thank you so much for bringing this to our attention.
That's
I'm
going
to be
thank
watching
you.
Very carefully when I get into my cab after this.
Oh, good. Thank you. Yeah, it's super easy. 311, and all you need is the cab number that you were in. If you get their phone number or if you get their name, that's great, but really just the cab number is the most important key.
Thank you, Micah.
Thank you.
Thanks for being on. So it's time for a quick break, but then we'll be back and we'll wrap up the show.